What does Godzilla and modern blobby architecture have in common? That they're both ugly monsters rampaging through our cities? No, quite the opposite. Both movie monsters and blobby buildings owe their inner beauty to the same source, the computer. In the finale to our series, we'll discover how computer technology has enabled architects, product designers, and animators to create the blobs of the modern age out of the classical shapes we've looked at so far. Godzilla was meant to be horrifying, but there is a surprising beauty behind the curvy buildings that grace the nation's skylines. Architectural critic Jonathan Glancy.
The blobby family is certainly taking over cities, actually across the world now. There's some wonderful, mad, charming, delightful ones popping up in England at the moment, which people can go and see in Britain. There's the new Selfridges in Birmingham, which is the most glorious blue, silver-disced blob. I suppose where it comes from is, first of all, architects being bored by conventional geometry. I mean, mathematical shapes are beautiful, but there's something in the end boring if every building looks the same. And then there's the computer, and the computer changes everything. Very few architects work on the drawing board now, they work on computer screens, and they can bend and twist shapes any way they want.
The computer gives you absolute accuracy and minimalises the margin for error, so it enables architects to be structurally and aesthetically much braver and bolder than they ever could be before.
Alice Rawsthorne is director of the Design Museum.
These aren't circles in the old-fashioned sense. They're not sort of pure, simply formed, perfectly round objects. They're much quirkier, more idiosyncratic, fluid, watery objects, commonly called the blob, because that's the simplest thing it looks like. If you think of Zaha Hadid, the architect's buildings, for example, like the Contemporary Art Center she's just built in Cincinnati, they are really complex, very sort of dreamlike, almost fantastical, curved forms.
So this is the Contemporary Art Center in Cincinnati. We really were very influenced by ideas of motion and movement and how through moving you can perceive space in a different kind of way.
Zaha Hadid is recognized as one of the most experimental architects in the world. Her designs for the Cardiff Opera House were so daring that no one was courageous enough to bring them to life. But the organic shapes that she likes to play with can be found in buildings like the Innsbruck ski jump or the tram station in Strasbourg, whose car park models the swirling lines of a magnetic field. In the art museum she designed in Cincinnati, she literally pulled the rug from under visitors' feet. The pavement runs under the building like a carpet, inviting people to enter the museum. Once inside, the urban carpet then curves dramatically upwards to create the main wall of the building.
We're looking at what we call the urban carpet, which is a wall which starts at the top of the building and comes all the way down, curves out like a kind of one of these roller skating curves, almost like a wall of a dam.
And do skateboarders like the urban carpet?
There's a message on it saying, you know, skateboarders on the outside. You should do it once a skateboarding show. I'm sure it would be fun.
I think I read that you did you studied mathematics at some point in your career. Has that influenced your architecture?
I think, yeah, it does influence the way you think, and I think it... Math was always quite easy for me. I always liked geometry and trigonometry and algebra as a kid, so I'm sure it had an influence.
And it's the geometry and trigonometry of the mathematician's palette that is the secret to realizing the strange, blobby shapes that architects are now building. One of the most stunning sights on the London skyline is the Swiss Re building. Nicknamed the Gherkin by locals, the architects responsible, Norman Foster and partners, prefer to describe it as a pine cone. Given the limited space available at the ground floor, the building maximises its volume by bulging out as you climb up the structure. I met two of the mathematicians, Hugh Whitehead and Francis Aish, who worked on the designs for this curvy building. Instead of another cube-shaped edifice, they wanted to smooth out the edges to create a shape that was beautiful yet functional. Hugh Whitehead.
When you look at the building from a long way off, it has a tremendous presence because of its unusual shape. But then as you walk towards it, curiously, it seems to get smaller because the building has no corners and it has no looming verticals. So that the building really is kind to its neighbours in all respects. And this also works in terms of the airflow. We did a number of studies and found that this aerodynamic shape actually reduces air turbulence around the building, whereas most new towers create problems. Common experience to find lots of old ladies thrown off their feet at the corners of new buildings, and this will never happen with Swiss Re.
I think it's a similar sort of thing to a plane. Most planes look very beautiful because they are very functional. I think some of these new buildings get their beauty from sort of working very hard as forms. They have to do many different things, and they have that same sort of elegance that an aircraft has.
Feels very mathematical in a way. You've got certain things you want the building to do to satisfy, and you want it to be as beautiful as possible, yeah. And so you've got to find a solution for this, and that sounds very much like solving a mathematical problem.
Exactly.
Concorde is a classic example because it's a very simple shape, but there's something about that aircraft that, unfortunately, you don't see it flying anymore, but it was a simple shape that continually surprised you. And I think curved buildings have similar capability because you really now have a new type of sculptural tool.
And although this computer technology is new to architecture, it's been around for a while in other areas of design. Charles Walker is an engineer and architect at Ove Arup's Advanced Geometry Unit.
You could trace it as far back as, say, the 1970s when the Ford Motor Company were moving towards very aerodynamic styling of the cars, and they needed new computer-aided design tools to describe sort of blob-shaped cars, if you like. In parallel with that, those tools have been developed in the computer gaming and animation industries. So we're tending to take software that's normally used for animating Godzilla and using it to draw buildings. They're the type of tools that are used to model Shrek's face.
Donkey?
Shrek! Come on, y'all!
And I saw her face! Ha ha! Now I'm a believer!
Given that we spend so much time consuming information and images from computer screens, clearly that experience will affect the way that we relate to our spatial environment. So if you walk into a building that's designed in blob-like form, like one of the incredible computer design museums created by architects like Zaha Hadid, that evokes exactly the same experience, that sort of slightly sort of hippy-giddy feeling of freedom.
I can't breathe. Now that people are more accustomed to 3D imagery, whether it's through animation on television or, computer games or cinema, it's much more easy to begin to engage with architecture. And I think that's kind of rather good and positive.
Donkey.
Yes, Rumi.
You're bothering me.
I believe in self-assertion, destiny or slight diversion. Now it seems I've got my head on straight.
So how are the likes of Shrek and Godzilla actually helping architects to create blobby shapes? Another building designed by Norman Foster and Partners is the Greater London Authority, home to London's mayor. Sitting on the banks of the River Thames, it looks like a distorted sphere or a glass pebble. And it was cartoon techniques that helped Hugh Whitehead to play around morphing classical shapes in the hunt for the perfect blob.
So if we take the idea of animation where you have a starting point where you might choose a shape like a square, and then if for your end point you choose a shape like a circle, in between you will get a transformation, a transition between square and circle. But in fact there are many different ways of transforming between a square and a circle, and somewhere in the process you may spot one that you like. Perhaps it isn't quite right. So you then select that as a freeze frame and manipulate that freeze frame that then becomes part of your animation.
So in a way that GLA building is a sphere, and it's like somebody's hit the sphere on the side and then it sort of started to shoot off, and you've chosen a moment to stop the film.
I think we pulled it gently rather than hit it.
Give us a hug, Shrek, you old love machine!
One of the charms of the new blobby buildings, whether hit or gently stretched, is the way they change so dramatically when viewed from a new perspective. A 2D plan for a cube or a sphere holds no surprises when it gets translated into 3D reality. But visualizing these new shapes can cause problems. What looked good on the 2D computer screen might suddenly look monstrous from an angle you hadn't checked. To overcome this, architects can now press a rather unusual print button. Charles Walker.
We can take a three-dimensional computer file and effectively send it directly to a solid printer, which prints in wax in layers of a thousandth of an inch, so we get wax models. and you can put it on your desk. It may look very good from one angle, but you move very slightly to the left and you realize it doesn't look good from another angle. This is also a very new area, and a lot of architects haven't learned this. So they're working from the computer straight to the building and then finding that from many angles it actually doesn't look very good.
To get to blobs, you've got to think outside the conventional shapes. A building can be absolutely anything, and if you can get an engineer to agree that it's possible and a contractor who's not scared to say, yes, I'm willing to build it, an insurance company willing to underwrite it, it's absolutely possible.
There's really only a group of manufacturers now who are able to take the three-dimensional information, which we give them in a computer file, and then use that directly for cutting steelwork. So, for example, I worked on some very large domes that cover an opera house in Singapore. And there, at every specific location, the actual machining of the metal was slightly different. So there we have one standard node, but within that we have 20,000 variations. It's rather like a puzzle. When they're assembling it on site, they have to lift out exactly the right component at exactly the right time to assemble it.
The computer is a powerful tool to help manufacturers to piece together these 3D jigsaws. But is it safe yet to sack all the mathematicians and trust our buildings to those digital zeros and ones? Francis H. believes it would be dangerous to clear the offices of those who understand how the computer makes these shapes. His experience of working on the Greater London Authority building is a telling testimony to this.
We were having problems transferring data between two different design systems. What we did is we went back and actually described it as a series of very simple mathematical steps, like a geometric recipe or a method statement. Anyone could understand how the building came together in a series of very simple steps. We also could then check the building at an Excel spreadsheet of every last coordinate of every glass panel, every bit of structure. And that way, going down to really the very kind of simple pure maths, it's a much more reliable way of understanding the building.
Computers really have given sort of an extraordinary power of creativity to people who work really intelligently with those blobs. Unfortunately, they've also enabled lots of very mediocre designers and architects to produce okay-ish, very blobby work. So there are a great many bad blobs out there, or sort of uninteresting blobs.
There is a risk, you know, with the sort of software nowadays, you can model pretty much anything, but it seems to sort of lead to a lot of these similar-looking blobby forms. I think it's sort of the mark of sort of a well-thought-out design process that will actually lead to more unique forms.
Does architecture need more mathematicians then, do you think?
I think that's something we're seeing beginning to happen. We are trying to extend our mathematical capability because people arrive from a school of architecture thinking they've been through the full training. They're actually relying too much on computers. You know, as long as there's a button, they're happy to press it.
There's no computer measure for beauty, so you still need sort of the kind of human in the loop to kind of have that subjective judgment. I think what we actually need is more sort of Renaissance men, more Leonardo da Vinci's, people who are at home with math as they are with art.
The blob has its heritage in the basic shapes civilizations have been playing around with for centuries. The sphere, the cube, the pyramid and the bagel. As I look around me now, I can't help seeing these simple shapes everywhere. From the food we eat, to the buildings we inhabit, from the products we play with, to the art we admire. It makes me appreciate that Renaissance man or woman is alive and well, shaping the world we live in.
Five Shapes was presented by Marcus de Sotoy. The producer was Erica Wright.
A major new series on BBC One.
Billions of years ago, two land masses south of the equator began drifting towards one another. Eventually, they crashed together to form a continent with peaks as high as the Himalayas and where coral-rich seas lap the shores. Polar bears roamed the ice that covered the land for thousands of years before making way for a mass of trees that would fuel an industrial revolution. It's a land scarred by wars, striped by canals, and now shaped by technology.
The British Isles. A natural history, 3 billion years in the making. Alan Titchmarsh unravels the story. Starts tomorrow night at 9 on BBC One.
There's a choice of listening on BBC Radio 4 now, in a moment, on FM. We continue our Book of the Week, which is The Life of Graham Greene by Norman Sherry. On Radio 4 198 Longwave now, it's time for the daily service, which is led this morning by Mark Coffey. Now on BBC Radio 4 FM, Book of the Week, and another reading from the life of Graham.